then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 12th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, I promised you guys last week that this week I'd get back into the comfort zone, so let's talk about murder. Now, as has been happening so often recently, we'll begin with our latest shooting spree in Las Vegas, blamed on so-called white supremacists. Not that the mainstream media or anyone else has any intention of reporting the truth, but still somebody at least has to go on record with the facts. For example, that loon down in California a couple of weeks ago was reported on the lefty lib blogosphere as being an example of white male privilege, whatever the hell that is. He wasn't even white, he was an Asian half-breed, and his old man was Hollywood glitterati, a good liberal Democrat on the side of the PC Angels, who supported the ruling party as a good Hollywood glitterati had ought to. Also, this kid killed his first three victims with a knife, which you'd think would put a spike in all the gun control nonsense the dictators, stenographers, and the media were caterwauling about, but not a bit of it. Our illustrious media never lets the facts get in the way of a good story. Now, the only one of these things recently that has had anything remotely to do with us at all is Fraser Glenn Miller's spaz attack in Kansas City back in April. I suppose we need to start a new feature on RFN, our weekly shooting spree blamed on white boys update. So here's this week's installment. If anybody cares, Jared and Amanda Miller were not quote-unquote white supremacists, as they have been portrayed in the media. They were weirded out, pothead libertarian types with a bent for conspiracy theory. The so-called neo-Nazi material found in their apartment appears to have been from Alex Jones, whom a lot of us swear is married to a Jewess. I don't know, I've never seen any actual evidence one way or the other, but the one thing Jones is not is a quote-unquote neo-Nazi. I saw Jared's so-called YouTube manifesto, where he was bitching about having to pay for his own house arrest monitoring equipment, which I admit is a bit thick. He was busted for selling marijuana, and now the court was demanding a $100 deposit and $9 a day he didn't have. Frankly, I think he was high when he made that video. There was not one single racial comment in the entire video or anything to indicate any affiliation with any of our groups. He wasn't even a skinhead. Apparently, he and Amanda did go down to the Clive and Bundy Ranch during the disturbances down there a couple of months ago, but they got run off for smoking weed and babbling about conspiracy theories. Right, let's move on now to the Bill White case. The only other authorized Bill White blogger, Gabriel D'Annunzio, is in occasional phone contact with Bill, and he tells me that Bill has in fact received some letters in the Seminole County Jail. Although, so far, 10 of them with URLs printed on them have been rejected as quote-unquote internet material, however they define that. I've tried sending him blog posts and whatnot with the link cut off at the top, don't know if he's getting those. Bill and Gabe are both of the opinion that his incoming and outgoing mail is being intercepted by the FBI and allegedly held in some unspecified place for reading and photocopying to make sure Bill isn't sending secret orders to kill, kill, kill to his non-existent followers, a la Joe Carroll, the name of the character portrayed by British actor James Purefoy on the TV series The Following, which is apparently what the FBI and the United States Attorney's Office are basing their Bill White narrative on. Like I said, Comrade D'Annunzio receives occasional phone calls from Bill himself, heavily monitored, of course. Now, I admit that I don't. I'm frankly twitchy about knowingly allowing the FBI to record my normal speaking voice, although God knows they've intercepted phone calls and podcasts enough to fabricate whatever audio they want of me trying to hire a hitman to kill Khloe Kardashian or whatever bizarre fabrication they come up with. D'Annunzio also tells me that Bill now has a court-appointed lawyer, which I didn't know, because I myself have heard nothing from Bill since he left Roanoke other than the one letter I ran a couple of weeks ago and in this month's Northwest Observer, the one where he had to borrow everything, the pen, the paper, the envelope, and the stamp. I hope he is able to reestablish a connection so that we can get back to work on Serpent's Blood, preventing which may also be a secondary cause for his present solitary status, although maybe that's a wee too paranoid even for me. I do know that several of the early chapters don't seem to have made it out of Roanoke, and various other bits and pieces suggest to me that someone in the regime is amazingly worried about a book on comparative religions. It's enough to make me wonder if a lot of the conspiracy theories aren't true. I have received nothing returned from the Seminole County Jail yet, including copies of those posts from which I cut the URL off. I have address labels with nothing but Bill's address on them, and I try to send him a couple of items every day. No word yet on whether Bill was allowed to receive any of the paperback books I've sent him. There's no point in my sending him any more until I can get some kind of confirmation of their receipt. Now, there's something I want to get into here, and it's going to sound a bit off the wall, but I honestly believe this is important to understanding what is happening to Bill White. The dictatorship has created its primary narrative in the Bill White case without any bona fide evidence that White has actually committed any crimes. Now, such evidence does not exist, and it has to be created prior to each trial through FBI intimidation, fabrication, subornation of perjury and collusion with federal prosecutors to pursue a purely politically motivated case, to the point where the sentencing judge in the last trial admitted in open court that Bill White was being persecuted for his political and racial beliefs. Then he sentenced a man he just stated he knew to be innocent. Anyway, got to keep up that 97% conviction rate. In the absence of any genuine evidence that Bill White has committed any crime at all, the Eric Holder Justice Department, with the assistance of the United States Attorney's offices in Roanoke, Virginia, and Orlando, Florida, appear to have become fixated on a bizarre internal case narrative of their own, which seems to be based on a Fox Network television show. Now, what can speak more eloquently of the whole American experience during the age of Obama? The frightening question here is, are the dictator's servants cynically using this narrative to manipulate dazed and confused American juries into convicting an innocent man through fear and intimidation? Or are the FBI agents and United States attorneys involved sufficiently out of touch with reality outside their carpeted and air-conditioned offices to believe it themselves? Fox Network's The Following stars actors Kevin Bacon and James Purefoy as the archetypes of good and evil. Bacon is the flawed but noble good guy, an FBI agent, of course, and Purefoy is the completely evil villain who persuades his followers to commit unspeakable acts of violence and terrorism for no apparent reason. As an aside, Hollywood movies and television series never adequately get into why the evil terrorists, domestic or Muslim, are doing what they're doing. As someone involved in the 9/11 investigation once said, 9/11 was the only homicide case I've ever worked on where the investigators were politically forbidden from looking for a motive for the crime. Now, in The Following, British actor James Purefoy portrays Joe Carroll, an insane professor of English literature, of all things, who somehow, from his faculty lounge in a second-string university, creates a worldwide death cult based on, wait for it, the writings of Edgar Allan Poe. He does this by mesmerizing confused and distraught young white people in a Svengali-like way. Now, we're shown this in the backstory sequences. And then somehow, we're never quite sure how, he makes the leap to persuading his brainwashed and utterly loyal following to commit acts of pointless non-political murder and violence while wearing Edgar Allan Poe masks. Yes, I know this sounds ridiculous, but Purefoy and Bacon are pretty good actors, and they managed to pull most of it off despite the wildly improbable plot and script. The series consists of good FBI guy Bacon chasing bad white guy Purefoy through multiple episodes, all the while carrying on an affair with Carol's wife, thus demonstrating that those who serve the dictatorship are the ones who get the pretty white woman. And yet Carol and his wicked followers always seem to stay one step ahead of them. Now, it seems that Joe Carroll's followers have almost magical powers of ubiquity and malice. Like pod people, the followers are everywhere. Teachers, lawyers, junkies, cops, media reporters, federal officials, nannies and babysitters, the waitress at the diner who fills the heroic FBI agent's morning coffee cup, the heroic FBI agent's intermittent girlfriend next door, besides Carroll's wife, of course, who sets him up. In Hollywood, heroic FBI agents who hunt down other white men at the behest of a third-world dictator get a lot of nookie. Ask Jack Bauer. Anyway, these followers are everywhere, concealing themselves, working their secret malevolent evil. Now, people who think white nationalists are paranoid should pay attention to some of the officially promulgated cultural tropes put out by the establishment to get a glimpse of the kind of paranoia that infects the life of the typical FBI agent or United States attorney. Now, the following is a good example. Brave and noble government officials in expensive suits and SUVs with wonderful, fulfilling lives are being stalked and attacked at every turn by ordinary, mostly white people who are conspiring against them, and so they just have to intercept our emails and listen to our phone conversations and follow us around with drones in the sky in order to maintain their lives of privilege and power. Of course they do. Don't you know that the followers are out there? Okay, cynically framing innocent people through planted evidence and suborned perjury is an old tradition in federal law enforcement, granted. But the idea that these expensively suited people getting the six-figure salaries courtesy of the taxpayer actually believe some of this drivel that they come up with in court is creepy and frightening. Power and psychosis is not a good combination, and being governed by crazy people is not a good thing. The courtroom narrative which the United States Attorney publicly maintains regarding Bill White is that he is a Joe Carroll-like cult guru with a nebulous band of followers who are hiding somewhere out there, hatching nefarious schemes of various kinds. Bill's got this kind of secret army of flying monkeys, and if the government doesn't keep him in prison for the rest of his life, he will raise his arms aloft and say, "Fly, fly, my pretties, go, go, kill." That appears to be pretty much the sum total of their case against him in some of these cases. And no one is quite sure just what Bill White's mysterious following is planning, and no one seems to know exactly who or where this nebulous following is. But they were the excuse used by the United States Attorney in Roanoke to anonymize the jury and thus terrify them out of their wits, letting them know before they had heard one word of testimony that Bill White was a wicked, dangerous man with an invisible army of followers who would hide under their beds at night and eat them all up if they didn't do their duty and convict White because the United States Attorney assured them that he was this bad man and should be kept in jail just forever and ever. Now, the fact that there is not one jot, not one tittle, not one scrap of evidence that this following exists anywhere outside the feverish and paranoid minds of certain United States attorneys, and possibly not even there, they may know full well that it's all crap. Now, apparently that doesn't matter. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain.
He's pounded down, loaded up and trucking. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done?
We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound just like no bandit run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal, son, never mind them brakes.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from, of all places, actually, I'm in the homeland in my backyard, soaking in the hot tub for you individuals that live down there in southern Mexifornia. I have a message for you. Get the hell out of there. A couple of months back, I was delivering to one of the DCs, one of them 99-cent chain places down there outside Los Angeles, and co-driver went in to go and turn in the, take the paperwork in to go and get the load off, and had to wait for another driver to show up because nobody there spoke any English. I mean, this is totally ridiculous. This is supposed to be the United States of America, not the United States of Mexico or Mexifornia. I do not comprehend why any company would hire someone who does not speak English. That should be required, mandatory. If you don't speak the language, either learn it or go the hell back where you came from, back where you belong. I mean, yeah, okay, if you're bilingual and stuff, that's fine. But at least speak the native language. And last time I checked, the native language for the United States of America was English. May not be British English, but nonetheless English. Yeah, that just blew my mind that we had to go and have somebody translate for us to be able to get the load delivered. I'm sorry if I'm going off on a little bit of a rant there, but this to me is absolutely ridiculous. On a lighter note, I just got done with my wife and son are members of the SCA, the Society for Creative Acronyms. They reenact the medieval thing, and they were doing their June fair and stuff up there in Port Gamble, and had a good weekend up there socializing with mostly white Americans and stuff that got into the medieval times and stuff. And yeah, that was a nice, enjoyable weekend. And the weather here is turning nice, so I really don't know why any of you would want to hang around there in hurricane country. I mean, good God, you have the hurricanes come through there, maybe not every year, but it's one of those, how many times does your property have to get destroyed before you finally get your heads out your asses and go somewhere where you don't have to worry about that? Yes, we have windstorms here. But you have those pretty much anywhere. No, we don't have tornadoes up here. So all y'all from the Midwest, that's a good point to look forward to. You don't have to worry about the twisters and the storm shelters and playing Dorothy and Toto. So as Mr. Covington, who I have yet to meet, has said, this is beautiful country, God's country, whatever you want to classify it as. This is nice, peaceful area and stuff, and it's turning into the summer season. Right now it's probably in the, you know, I guess mid-50s. It's in the evening. Sun just went down a little bit ago. Looking at stars here. Yeah, we can see those here, or we don't have the massive amounts of light pollution like you'd have in Southern California, there in the L.A., Orange County area. At least we can look up and see stars and stuff and have nice, peaceful area. Yeah, it's nice and green, the evergreen state, or sometimes we like to call it the ever-wet state, but that's what makes it green is it rains. This afternoon, I was out there hanging new chain-link fence to get rid of some chicken wire fence that we had up around the front yard. So, anyway, comrades, get your assets up here. Hope to see you out here on the road soon. If you see some old white fart running around with a 1911 on his hip, that's probably me. All right, comrades, have a good one. We'll see you soon up here in the homeland.
He's bound to die, loaded up and trucking. Are we going to do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound to watch our bandit run.
All right, first music break. I don't know who this group is, and there's a reason for that. They're British, and if the authorities in the United Kingdom find out that they played and recorded this song, they will go to prison for at least 7 years. God, isn't that horrific? We think things like that can't really happen in the real world, but they do. The Bobbies from the local hate crime squad in Yorkshire just arrested one of the heretical two again for the crime of accessing the internet while on parole. Anyway, this is called the Immigration Song.
We came to England through the tunnel last night.
That's right, that's right.
We claim asylum, now they're treating us right.
So right, so
oh,
right.
Oh, something tells me, Ahmed, this is the place to be. Cause here we're getting everything and we're getting it for free. Oh, I've got a brand new leather jacket and a brand new mobile phone. Brits, they live in cardboard boxes while we get furnished homes. Legal aid, driving lessons, central heating and free pills. Oh, we get all the benefits and you get all the bills. They drove a lorry from IKEA straight away.
You pay, you pay.
TVs and furniture, it was mostly okay.
You pay, you
but the
pay.
Flat, it wasn't suitable. The council's run by fools. After crossing 15 countries, we need heated swimming pools.
Oh, I've got a brand new leather jacket and a brand new mobile phone. Brits, they live in cardboard boxes while we get furnished homes. Legal aid, driving lessons, central heating and free pills. Oh, we get all the benefits and you get all the bills.
We go to garages to buy nice motor car.
Price is no bar.
Flash BMW, cause we come so far.
Price is no bar.
It costs many thousands, but man, oh what the heck. We come back tomorrow and we pay with a welfare check.
Oh, I've got a brand new leather jacket and a brand new mobile phone. Brits, they live in cardboard boxes while we get furnished homes. Legal aid, driving lessons, central heating and free pills. Oh, we get all the benefits and you get all the bills.
We take our trolleys round Tesco's each day.
You pay, you pay.
Pal hal with goodies, oh that is the way.
You pay, you pay.
Food and drink and CDs, phone cards and blue jeans. Old lady, she get angry, so we stole her tin of beans.
Oh, I've got a brand new leather jacket and a brand new mobile phone. Brits, they live in cardboard boxes while we get furnished homes. Legal aid, driving lessons, central heating and free pills. Oh, we get all the benefits and you get all the bills.
We get TV license, gas, electricity.
For me, for me.
Your generosity is amazing to see.
For me, for
you
me.
You even pay our phone bill, so we call Afghanistan. Tell all our friends to come here and live on Englishman.
Oh, I've got a brand new leather jacket and a brand new mobile phone. Brits, they live in cardboard boxes while we get furnished homes. Legal aid, driving lessons, central heating and free pills. Oh, we get all the benefits and you get all the bills.
Our friends in Parliament, they all on our side.
Cock-eye, cock-eye.
Sometimes they talk tough, but you know it's a lie.
Cock-eye,
immigration
cock-eye.
Is a good thing, on that they all agree. The only ones who'll stop it are the wicked BNP.
Oh, I've got a brand new leather jacket and a brand new mobile phone. Brits, they live in cardboard boxes while we get furnished homes. Legal aid, driving lessons, central heating and free pills. Oh, we get all the benefits and you get all the bills.
Thank you. would like to talk about the Broder Swiden book, and this is the first volume, so apparently there is or there will be a second volume. Now, this book, of course, deals with movement history going back into the 80s. It talks about, well, it names a lot of names, and I don't know how many of those names I can really mention here, but of course, it really stars Bob Matthews. To a lesser extent, it talks of David Lane, and De Silva's memoirs, of course. The order was really formulated from a group of men that really, at the end of the day, had a lot of things in common. Very often, they were interested in gun rights. Many of them had come from the John Birch Society. And there was also a strong anti-tax influence. Now, to a certain degree, you also had CIA and British Israelism thrown into the mix. There's a little bit of Klan, but De Silva talks about how he had at one point become involved with the Klan, but he became quickly disillusioned. And eventually, these men start getting involved with the Aryan Nations, particularly the Congress meetings there. It's quite interesting because you see the evolution of these men where at first they're still somewhat tied to the system. They're interested in the Constitution, for example, and they have some sympathies for local police. But over time they do get more and more radicalized. They're radicalized by one event in particular, a Unity Street Walk that they plan in California. And that's in solidarity with a police officer that was killed in the line of duty. They do have some misgivings about this street walk, but they decide to go through with it anyway. A lot of important individuals are jailed, including Richard Butler. It really becomes difficult for all the families because, of course, there's bail, and to become worried about going to prison just because of a street walk. And, of course, one of the things that happens, and one of the dangers in all of this that happens with Aryan Nations, especially with their congresses, is that because it's somewhat of a compound scheme, it does attract some infiltrators, and that is mentioned in this book. Even though it's only a small number of infiltrators, it's enough to do harm. The other thing you learn about in this book is some collaboration with a foreign group, because it does talk about one gentleman that comes from Germany. There's some, talks about some degree of cross-pollination, someone by the name of Manfred. Now, of course, funding was always an issue. At first, these men that later on become the Order, at first they work in the timber industry in the Northwest. They find they're just not gaining enough money from that. And they really find that, unfortunately, there's no legal way for them to make enough money. So finally, at the end of this book, get together and decide to resort to more drastic measures, although there is one individual in particular in the group who objects to that. And I'm not going to go into the name of this individual because I don't know whether he's alive or not. He may not be, but this book is a field of names, and I know on this show we can't always mention names. But he objects for ethical reasons and religious reasons, but eventually goes along with it out of a sense of duty. Now, you meet Bob Matthews in this book, and you see that he's really a firebrand. And I'm sorry, that comment may have been a bit inappropriate given his death, but he really is, he's extremely zealous. And at the end of the day, of course, you know, these men, being men of action, they're constantly getting themselves into trouble with FBI and also with JDL. And they realize primarily that all the conservative means of redress to any issues are just not getting anywhere. That's why they become so disillusioned with a more conventional approach. and they realize that there has to be a territorial imperative. They're willing to have an above-ground political movement, but they also see a need for an underground movement. I have to say, I've had the experience of living in a part of the country where there are a lot of Jewish individuals, and not that this is a topic that comes up often, but I know that the Jewish community, they remember what happened to Allen Berg. They may not know about some branch of the Klan. They may not know about some branch of the ANP or something like that. But apparently, at least back in the 90s, I mean, maybe it's kind of faded in memory today, perhaps, there was a concern about what happened to Allen Berg. I remember back when I was in college having a conversation with somebody who was Jewish, and they said, well, I'd never want to be a talk show host. And I said, oh, why wouldn't you want to be a talk show host? Because I thought, you know, maybe that would be interesting. And they said, well, look at what happened to Allen Berg. So that's the only time in my life I've ever heard anything like that. So this group, they were serious, and everybody knew that. And that's why they were being watched, probably, from the beginning. You know, the men of the Order, they really saw themselves as, at the end of the day, part of a new generation. It talks about their great admiration for Butler, but they said that those who were a bit younger than Butler could see the situation even more clearly, and they saw Butler as someone who paved the way for warriors to come. Now, I also have to mention Don Musgrove, who I assume is now deceased because evidently he had a very serious illness. Despite his serious illness, which was cystic fibrosis, which is an illness that does come about in the Northern European whites, he was a tremendous help with all of his expertise. Now, Don was somebody that worked with Rockwell. He apparently studied the law. He might have also been an accountant, I'm not sure. So he was somebody that was rather scholarly and was able to help in those ways and was very hardworking despite his illness. So, I have to say, this is a really interesting book because it's a very frank history. It's a very, you know, it's a very honest look at the development of the Order, and it's a snapshot of that period in time and what was going on. Certainly, it was a time very much dominated in place, very much dominated by CI, and it'll also mention Covenant Sword and Armor of the Lord, which was another group from back in the 80s that you may have heard of. Today, I would say that the scene is more diverse in terms of religious views, and I don't know, maybe more of an international scene in some sense. At any rate, I'd certainly recommend this book. It is not available on Kindle. It's only available in a traditional book form. And it's quite a long book. But you'll still find the writing, I would say, very succinct. So at any rate, I hope you enjoyed this review. Hail victory, comrades, and thank you for listening.
Oh, before I forget, I found the tag end of that Mike Harris show I did a couple of weeks ago, and guess I might as well drop that in here now.
Well, it is, but I want to go back to an earlier comment you made, and that is about how this government seems to be against a small business. And they're really against all entrepreneurial. I mean, the entrepreneurial class has been systematically destroyed, and this began back under Reagan. Reagan did two things to really, really, really hurt small business and to hurt the American worker. One of them is he broke up the PATCO union, the air traffic controllers. He killed the unions with that move by putting that union out of business. He just really went above and beyond, and that was a betrayal of the constituents, the people of the United States. I really cannot say enough about Reagan about that. It was a very bad thing. The other thing that he did, was through deregulation. Now, if you remember, pre-Reagan, we had, 45 or 50 airlines in this country. We had over 300 media companies in this country. We had telecom providers that were innumerable. And once deregulation hit, it was supposed to increase competition. Well, it didn't increase competition. It destroyed competition. And what it did is it, you know, when the airlines, for instance, we had 45, 50 independent airlines. What happened to Braniff, Piedmont, PSA? All of these airlines are gone. They've all been absorbed. They've all been rolled up is what the private equity term is. They call it a roll up. And they've been rolling up industry after industry to gain complete control over the American economy. You look at the media companies. You know, we used to have over 300 independent television, radio, and other broadcast media here in this country, not to mention publishing and everything. You can't even get a child school book now that isn't controlled by one of the big six media companies. We now have six media companies that control 99% of everything that anyone reads, watches, or hears. These are things that are happening to the U.S. And what we're seeing is we're seeing the reverse of communism. Whereas communism had one state source, what we're seeing is we're taking many sources and consolidating them into fewer and fewer and fewer right. sources. And so we're achieving the same goals that the Bolsheviks wanted under communism, except they're using capitalism to get there. And it's
monopoly capitalism. Yeah, well, communism and capitalism have always been basically are different sides of the same coin. They are both completely materialistic worldviews. But you know, both the Democrats and the Republicans hold the same essential view of American society. They do not like and they distrust any person, by which, by the way, I mean white person who is in control of his own economic destiny. They don't like independent contractors, people who work with their own hands, make their own livings, run their own businesses, etc., because they are not subject or they're much less subject to what the left terms economic discipline. The American society today uses money and paychecks and whatnot as employment, as a form of control. The only real difference between the two is that the Democrats want those checks coming from the government in one form or another, and the Republicans want them coming from one of about 8 or 10 big, huge multinational conglomerates. But you see, when a man is dependent on a paycheck in order to support himself, support his family, and live some kind of life, all you have to do is threaten that paycheck, and he steps into line. He falls like a lawn chair in the case of Americans. They've discovered this, and the one thing that neither party and the one thing the system simply does not like is the man who is economically independent. So yes, it's essentially the same form of wage slavery, if you would, except that I say there's a difference in application. The Democrats want this big, huge, socialistic style nanny state to control all the paychecks and all the money and dole it out and accordingly be able to tell people how they can live and whether they can smoke and whether they can drive a car and all this sort of stuff. The Republicans, I don't think, care so much about people's private lives. They just like the money and the power. But they want it coming from all these big, huge corporations. And, of course, when you've got that much money and that much wealth and influence and power concentrated in a few corporate boardrooms, you can still exercise all kinds of social control by simply getting to or making a deal with the faceless men in the suits who sit in the boardrooms. So, yeah, the end result is the same. The same with immigration. The Democrats want this mass immigration to keep going because, as far as they're concerned, those are future Democrat voters. And if Boehner and the Republicans yield on this immigration thing in the House, you know, they're handing a one-party state to the Democrats for the next 50 years, and I don't know why they can't seem to understand that. Republicans, on the other hand, want the immigration to continue as a source of cheap labor. They don't care that it's destroying American society and destroying the country. I mean, I really would tremble in many ways to be a young, lower middle class or working class white man or white boy coming up in the world now, 17, 18 years old. You're just out of high school. You've got no choices, really. Even if you can get into a decent college, which is harder and harder for white males, you end up with a, you know, $150,000 student loan debt that you can't bankrupt out of. And your choices in life are just so limited. This is why we have to have either the Northwest Front or some kind of political movement to reach out to young white people. This is, I'm kind of digressing here, but this has always been one of my problems with our movement. It seems to take us so long to learn wisdom. I mean, you know, you and me are both great guys, et cetera, et cetera. But let's face it, Mike, we don't have too much tread left on the tire. We have got to find some way to reach young white men and women and wake them up a lot earlier than their mid-40s, which is when most white people seem to wake up and learn a little bit of wisdom as to what's going on. Because if there is going to be any hope, we have got to take this last young white generation and educate them and make them aware of who they are, who their enemies are, and what they have to do about it, which is something I try to do in my novels. You'll notice that most of the protagonists in my novels are young kids who are caught up in political correctness and who fight back. You see what I'm saying here?
Well, I do exactly that. I see exactly what you're saying here, Harold, and I think you're correct on that. And really, the legacy that we're leaving for our children and our grandchildren is pathetic. You know, we have to remember that this happened on our watch. We let this happen. And one of the things that I want to point out is that these forces of evil, I will call them, those who wish to destroy this country, those who are wishing to bring in these immigrant hordes and send our jobs overseas and turn this into a socialist, a workers' paradise, they've been fighting an asymmetrical war that has been fought in the shadows, has been fought in secret, and we haven't even been aware that they've been fighting a war against us until just recently. And now we're waking up, and I hear our music coming up. Harold, we'll be right back right after this short break. More with Harold Covington.
Okay.
This is Steve Earle.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Today I'm going over Real Politics Talk number 6, which covers the problem we need to address if we are to survive the current brownout of white countries. Of course, anyone who heard my talk on the politics of race in Real Politics 4 should be able to immediately guess what the problem is. But there's a little more to it than just naming the problem. In light of several decades of whatever it is we've been doing, there are a handful of serious efforts which we can analyze against the problem definition to see how they stack up. This sort of analysis will reveal exactly what has gone wrong and where our past political thought has failed us. I'm going to avoid discussion of the solution itself. What I'll eventually propose ought to be obvious enough to anyone not listening to Radio Free Northwest for the first time. That aside, I'm not serving anyone's interests if I don't process various ideologies and proposed solutions against the realities of race, to illustrate exactly why white nationalism has failed, and will continue to fail, as long as we refuse to adopt a serious, mature, and responsible approach to our political and strategic decisions. If my repeated use of that phrase insults those of you who aren't on the same page as the party, then good. I hope it pisses you off. That way, you're on the verge of learning something. Pay close attention today, and you'll be very, very near to understanding why the Northwest Imperative is the only thing we've got left. With that as my purpose, I've got to ask you all to stop and seriously consider how it is that perhaps tens of thousands of people, in dozens of outfits, over the aforementioned several decades have all, presumably, been involved in the exact same thing we are now, without coming to anything resembling the same statement of the problem, let alone the same statement of the solution. It's not as if we've been narrowly focused such that we missed something obvious, or without motivation such that we generally didn't keep at the task. We certainly haven't failed for relying on one person. Quite the opposite, since we've had more than our fair share of leadership candidates parade themselves before us, and insist they knew exactly what was wrong and how to fix it. If nothing else, we know for a fact we aren't introspective enough, or else you would have heard this before now, from somewhere other than the Northwest Front. And the white nationalist movement has produced some of the world's finest propaganda to support its claims. So what gives? As I said before, the actual problem was all but stated in my Realpolitics 4 talk on race. Recently, Gretchen reviewed De Silva's book, Rise of the West, and her report also included a couple of very important remarks I suspect most of the Radio Free Northwest audience chose to ignore because they were uninteresting in and of themselves. Multiculturalism means white nationalism will fail because racial diversity always means race mixing. The integrity of our race must be our primary concern. Okay, that's not exactly news, and it isn't especially profound, so I can't expect very many of you to obsess over it. But recall all of white history as I so very briefly went over some weeks ago. White genocide has been a common aspect of human history, and it's always preceded by what we've come to call multiculturalism. White people only prosper when they have their own territory free of non-whites, and their own societies free of non-white cultural influence, particularly the corruption Jews bring with them as a part of their presence. Okay, I'm still not saying anything too thrilling, but this is the next logical step behind all of the words white nationalism has been slinging for all these years. Sure, white people are under the immediate threat in the next few decades of physical extinction all around the world. And sure, it's wrong. And sure, there's an unbelievable amount of suffering and evil involved. We all get this, and we're all quite happy to remind ourselves and each other of it at every possible opportunity. We're especially glad to run across material which we believe confirms it to be true. But we don't want to go any further lest we come to the underlying reason these terrifying things are happening to us. If we ask the question behind the question, which is always, why, then we run the risk of encountering something we might actually be able to change. This could easily be the reason white nationalism has done everything but genuine politics for much, much longer than I've even been alive. Alright, so white people need their own countries where only they can live and exercise political power for their own benefit. That's the underlying problem we're going to have to solve if we want any hope of racial survival past the next handful of decades. This is still probably not very interesting to many of us since we've heard it over and over and over. Okay, fine. I would almost leave it alone, except that nothing we've ever done has stood up against it, and nothing currently being considered, save the Northwest Imperative, will ever stand up against it. The problem has been stated so many times over that we're largely immune to the intended effects of hearing it restated. Instead of repeating the problem over and over, I'm going to instead attempt to convey an understanding of that problem in the hopes that some of what the party has been trying to get across to all of you will actually sink in. The selection of proposed actions or objectives of white nationalism, which is so wide as to not exclude a single thing, it could be entirely summed up as irrelevant. Quite some time ago, I did a talk or two on what constitutes a solution. That discussion was admittedly abstract and formal. For the remaining part of today's segment, I'm going to contrast each type of solution against the problem behind the problem. Each of them is going to fall flat on its face, and the ways in which they fail will help us understand why falling short of obeying the Northwest Imperative guarantees white genocide will march on otherwise undeterred. I'll start out lowballing it by using easy examples which might be suggested by a paleo or even a neocon, since you are all more likely to be receptive to criticizing them. Now then, one common suggestion we hear from American conservatives is that we all vote Republican. Let's posit for our consideration that there is a complete and total sweep of Republican electoral victories across the entire country. Every elected official is a conservative Republican. No rhinos. Further, every appointed official has been replaced by these new Republicans. There's no one even approaching liberal or Democrat in office. But what then? You'll recall from my talk on race theory that the mere presence of non-whites in white territory causes white genocide. What are these Republicans going to do? Ban non-whites? Ban whole races? Well, that certainly would be amusing. But that's all it would be. Even in this wildly imaginative situation, the yellow, black, and brown masses aren't going to have any. Are they just going to go away without any sort of disagreement on the matter? No, I'm afraid not. In fact, they might just make us go away. White people, Americans especially, have a penchant for pitching a fit about what other people can't do because they're not allowed to. I can imagine all of you who refuse to migrate being slaughtered by MUDs in this scenario while screaming about how said MUDs are supposed to leave you alone because it's the damned law. Really, any situation involving system politics would end this way. Even if all the civil rights laws are repealed and widespread racial discrimination takes effect, remember that this in and of itself wouldn't mean much because civil rights laws aren't what cause white genocide. Legal and political solutions just don't cut it. I frequently run into all varieties of sovereign citizens, and while I'm told by decent sources everything they say is totally true, it doesn't matter one lick. Let's say we get the government to completely leave us alone, and we're totally free to do as we please. There's still the biology problem. Even if we weren't compelled to associate with, hire, or live around our racial enemies, they would still be present, and this completely and totally guarantees our racial destruction. Solutions which do not address the presence of non-whites do not factor into the course of history. Remember real politics war on race. Failure to maintain a strictly white population always results in disaster. This is true regardless of the number of white people involved, too. White people aren't ever, ever going to outbreed other races, and while more white people is always a good thing, there aren't ever going to be enough to ensure we survive by numbers alone. Another type of solution opted for is religious in nature. This is almost always in the form of semi-compulsory Christianity, but that's by no means the only variety on offer. When I make remarks on this topic, everyone is fair game because I'm criticizing your behavior, not your faith. Let's just say everyone you want to ends up converting. Well, the trouble is that we've had all sorts of racist white religions in the past, and none of them ever stopped white genocide. You've got no reason to think getting every white person on the same page religiously is going to prevent a non-religious trend from continuing to completion. If your thing is working for you, that's just fine. But remember, almost every religion is treated like a buffet. People pick up too much of what they like and none of what they don't, which always artificially enhances their enthusiasm. I'm quite pleased that you're getting what you need from whatever tradition you've adopted, but ultimately, because of the personal nature of it, you're the source of whatever inspiration and benefit it has produced. There's no reason to think what does it for you will do it for someone else, and there's definitely no reason to think someone else is worse off for not sharing your religion. Everyone's motivation is going to be unique to them, and remember, if you've got any sort of white nationalist-friendly faith, it's going to encourage racial loyalty first. If you're taking your own faith seriously, you'll surely understand the criteria for success is biological, just like the problem itself. My personal favorite, the White Enclave, is probably the leading alternative to the Northwest Imperative, but it's just not good enough. I've been bombarded with requests for my blessing of the Enclave idea many times, and I'm never going to give it. It sure is nice to imagine running off to some little town where everyone's white and your family won't have to put up with the modern world. But it won't last. What are you going to do when the first MUDs roll up looking for some work? What would happen when someone tries running them out of town? Nothing good if the federal government still exists. And if it doesn't, your little hamlet isn't going to have the resources it needs to deal with the roaming hordes of non-white, which America will have become. Remember, no one ever did what they were supposed to do, and there's no safe place where only white people can live and keep their families. All enclaves do is put the hard stuff past the point where our last possible hope will be possible at all. One more small batch of white kids, and then it's really all over with. Don't fall for the illusion of the enclave. We have everything we need within ourselves to make the choice to confront the issues behind white genocide, if we'll only choose to do so. This isn't up for debate. Further, it bothers me deeply that the Northwest Front is the only outfit who will insist the problem actually be confronted. Don't the loud, prominent, anti-Northwest voices in the movement realize how suspicious they seem when they talk about everything but actually creating an independent, sovereign, whites-only country? And more importantly, why do any of you think these people have something to offer? Have they once suggested something else which might arrest the cause of white genocide? The obvious answer is no, and we would each do well to shun them because of it. Hail victory, comrades.
And here's some more Steve Earle.
I took a stroll on the old long walk of the day. I met a little girl and we stopped to talk of a fine soft day. And I asked your friend, what's a fella to do? Cause your hair's black and her eyes are blue. And I knew right then, have a taken a whirl. A saw-tail prime with a Galway curl. Oh. We're halfway there when the rain came down on the day. Cast me up to a flat downtown on a fine soft day. Heart, a ticket
Right, quick email from Jason in Arizona. Dear Harold, last week you were using some strange terms. What do you mean by the term brought across? You also used the term muggles. Are you into Harry Potter as well as H.P. Lovecraft? No, not really, but I'm familiar with the Potter mythos, so to speak. I'm surprised anybody noticed my phraseology last week, but I believe that we need a whole new lexicon or vocabulary to describe certain ideas and concepts. For example, for many years, I used the term racially conscious community to describe us instead of the almost meaningless term movement. The term movement implies forward motion, of which we have virtually none, unless it's the orbital motion of our circling the bowl before America decides to flush. I've fallen back into old habits recently and started referring to the movement all the time, and I suppose I better work on that. Other than the Northwest Front, there is no movement of any kind in any sense of the term. But moving right along here, I think we need new terms describing certain racial and political concepts that apply to what little we do have going on right now, including a way to describe ignorant, non-racialist white people who are still dazed and confused and who have no idea who they are, as Pastor Miles would say. Some term other than white dumbasses, which I got a complaint about last week, which I suppose is fair enough. Also, some new and more punchy terms describing the process of racial awakening. I've occasionally used the term muggles in the past to describe our unawakened racial brothers and sisters, and which does come from the Harry Potter books and means ordinary non-magical human beings, whereas Harry and his pals are magical people, wizards and witches, and I think that's not a bad simile. Now, we have the magic of racial knowledge and Jew awareness, and thereby a racial connection to the cosmos that most white people don't. The term brought across to describe the birth of racial consciousness in a white man or woman is a little more esoteric and semi-Lovecraftian than muggles. I'm not into the whole vampire shtick, although I do tell people that if you want to get a good look at my part of the homeland, watch the first Twilight movie. It was filmed up around Forks, Washington, which is a few miles north of here. But back in the 90s, I was going through one of my brief periods when I had cable TV, and I caught a few episodes of a Canadian vampire series, which I won't name or get into, but one thing did stick in my mind. The term that they used for becoming a vampire, in other words, separating yourself from the common run of sheep-like humanity, was to be brought across the abyss. I think that actually kind of fits what we do. We bring people across an abyss. A chasm of ignorance and lies, and if they can make the passage safely, and if they don't panic and lose their nerve and flee back into the comfort of the herd, they arrive on the other side, in a land of illumination and knowledge of who they are and why they are. Anyway, guys, what do you think? Do these metaphors sound serviceable at all? Now, here's another email I got recently. Dear HAC, I somehow ended up on one of your email lists a couple of years ago, and I've listened to every episode of Radio Free Northwest. In the interest of brevity, and in order not to waste any more of your valuable time than necessary, I'll try to give you a brief summary of who and what I am. I am a 47-year-old white male who was born and raised in Boston, but who has been living in rural New Hampshire for 12 years, and he goes into a long stuff about his ancestry, which I won't get into. I am the divorced father of a 13-year-old son and 11-year-old daughter that I get to have every other weekend. Their mother is unfortunately 100% allergic to any political or racial or historical thought or discussion, and would actually get up and leave the room whenever I was teaching friends or family about race, history, the Jews, etc. Thankfully, my girlfriend of almost 3 years is much more interested in and open to those subjects. Through some miracle, I somehow found a 33-year-old intelligent American woman, on the East Coast no less, who wasn't completely brainwashed by political correctness. I'm sure you can guess most of the rest of the story. My wife decided to wait until I had finally worked out a mortgage modification with Wells Fargo to inform me that she had decided to take advantage of New Hampshire's liberal no-fault divorce laws and help herself to custody of my children and roughly 30% of my income. Bankruptcy and foreclosure soon followed, although I did manage to squat in my own house for close to a year and a half before the sheriff put me out. I had only paid Wells Fargo $200,000 over the last 10 years for my $225,000 house, so that seemed fair. And yes, I had been underemployed for some time leading up to those events. After almost 20 years in the motorsports industry, selling at and managing motorcycle dealerships, I ended up making $10 an hour babysitting retarded child molesters overnight, literally, because it was the first job I came across with benefits, and it really didn't occur to me to sit at home on the couch and collect $400 a week in unemployment, plus $500 in food stamps and free state health insurance. Tough being a white man at times, ain't it? For the past 6 years, I have also had a second, often full-time job, escorting oversized vehicles some days during the week. 3 months ago, I was laid off from the babysitting job when they closed the house I was working at, and I've been escorting full-time ever since. Right, I'm sure you're convinced that I don't understand the definition of the word brevity at this point, but I did want to give you enough information so that you have some idea who's talking at you. Signed, Mike from New Hampshire. Yes, Mike, I do know who's talking to me. A king who has been dispossessed from his throne and exiled from his world, and who now wanders a land haunted by ghosts and demons and wild beasts. There are a lot of you out there. How many millions more white men like Mike are out there, people? You have to find them and bring them to me. Well, our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.